Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name is Joseph Earp, and in phone, there's Dan Dixon in phone form. He's not standing like 10 miles away from the microphone. He's just a phone. He's in a phone.
Although I might be standing 10 miles away from the microphone, actually.
That's true.
Technically.
We are
in the same city.
We're on FaceTime, so I can see Dan. He's looks like he's trapped in a little box. And his voice kind of sounds like it, too. How are you, Dan?
I'm okay. So the reason we're doing this is that I had wanted to watch the next film, but have managed, to be honest and pretty characteristically, to overwhelm myself with work to such a degree that I have not had time. And Joe very helpfully suggested that we record a kind of mini-sode, but we'll see how this goes. And we're doing it remotely just for expedience, but we won't be talking about a movie. We will still be talking about Brad Pitt. I am tired and stressed, but I couldn't be happier to be seeing my friend Joe in his little box on my screen and talking about Brad Pitt.
And talking about Bradley, because of course it's been a while since we talked about Bradley, because the last episode was Friday the 13th, part 8. There's not actually been a lot of Brad Pitt news. I think we will now find a dearth of Brad Pitt news. He promised.
Unless he gets coronavirus.
We should say we are recording in the early days of the corona pandemic.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks got coronavirus today. Sorry to this man.
And his wife.
Yeah, Rita Wilson also got coronavirus, which, you know, it reminded me a little bit. Do you remember there was like, people were scared of this outbreak of like a zombie virus a couple of years ago. And Vanilla Ice got quarantined on his plane. Just, you know, the way you forget that, like, celebrities are things in the world and, like, any random assortment of people will include some celebrities, including Vanilla Ice.
And Tom Hanks.
And he got it on the Gold Coast as well. Poor Tom.
Which I, as a Queenslander, feel simultaneously ashamed and I pity Tom Hanks for just having to be on the Gold Coast. Well, not only is he on the Gold Coast, he's filming a Baz Luhrmann Elvis biopic.
Which, you know, I don't love every Luhrmann film, but I like Baz Luhrmann broadly. And I had the worry, what if Baz Luhrmann has coronavirus?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course, I didn't even. Yeah.
What would happen? Baz would struggle with coronavirus. Like, he's in the upper age bracket, right? Like, he's getting into dangerous territory for Baz Luhrmann. What's going to happen to film production? What happens to movies? What happens to the Mortal Kombat film they're making in the Gold Coast? What happens to Mel Gibson's Wild Bunch remake? Like, do they all films shut down?
I think so. They've moved the Bond film as well. I mean, that's just a matter of people not being able to spend time in cinemas together.
You would think that with some big films, Netflix is going to, like, have a big year of just, like, buying films that have been shelved from theatrical distribution because of coronavirus.
It's the year of Netflix, surely. This is, like, ideal for them. Everyone is locked inside and terrified to leave their house and needing distraction.
It's also, in a self-interested way, I've finished a book manuscript a couple of months ago, which I'm now trying to sell. And I'm trying to sell it to publishers with the proviso of, like, hey, people are going to be looking for something to read. People want to, like, sit at home and read my disturbing, fucked up book. Because, like, you know, surely more people will read and more people will watch Netflix because of coronavirus.
Definitely. I've got a lot of books to catch up on. I'm really going to try and not just spend all my time on Twitter. That's the goal.
Well, problem with Twitter during these times is that Twitter is at its best when something fucks up happens. Like, Tom Hanks got coronavirus today. Twitter was the most enjoyable it's been for a long time.
You know, look, just when this episode is released, which will be for posterity, I hope Tom Hanks is still, honestly, we have to account for the fact that we don't know how this is going to unfold. And looking back, we want to be sensitive.
Chet Hanks, Tom Hanks' son, said that Tom is fine. He'd filmed a video with his shirt off and he was like, listen, Dad's got coronavirus, it's crazy, but he's fine.
And who can we trust if not Chet Hanks in these troubling times?
Exactly.
Did you see the footage on Twitter, speaking of Twitter being at its peak in these times, of Whoopi Goldberg welcoming an audience-less room to The View?
Yes.
So there's no one in the seats. and Whoopi Goldberg is saying, "Welcome to the view, welcome to the view," and the camera is cutting to empty seats as the view panels sit, as if they would, if there were an audience in there. Very unsettling, but also powerful.
I mean, I don't think that coronavirus is anything close to the end times. Like, I'm not that kind of person. I do think that it's like, poses a threat to like large swathes of the community. And then, so of course we end up trading in discussions of like apocalyptic imagery. It is interesting to me the way that you very quickly become used to apocalyptic imagery. Like, what you're talking about, right? Like, Whoopi Goldberg is introducing empty seats because no one can go fucking outside because there's, like, a deadly pandemic. And we all know that, but it's funny. First and foremost, it's funny, not scary. Yeah. And I guess,
which is surely a defense mechanism, right?
Is it a defense mechanism? Maybe. It just doesn't... I feel like sci-fi hasn't properly accounted for the fact that, like... It doesn't have to be a scary authoritarian thing. We can just all go along with this apocalyptic shit because it's kind of funny.
It helps. I mean, yeah. I mean, this is turning into the Corona cast. But the Trump address to the nation, where he looked like he had the sniffles and, like, tired, was equally absurd. I mean, it's not... But, yeah, again, it's primarily shockingly absurd before it is frightening.
It's the other big thing, which I think is, like, Brad Pitt adjacent, is, like, I do think the way that cinema is posed in the year 2020 is probably the art form best posed at the moment to survive economically what we're going to see as, like, a coronavirus-spurred recession. Like, you know, I'm a music journalist these days, like... didn't plan on being. I actually don't like the music industry very much. And all I'm writing about at the moment is festivals being cancelled, shows being cancelled, international tours being cancelled. We have all these streaming services that are perfectly in place to not be hurt at all. I mean, the production of new movies will be a problem, but maybe it will give us all some fucking time to catch up on all the shows that we have to watch.
For sure. And I'm sure there's a lot of stuff being out there being sold that's like being filmed and in the can, and that will be coming out over the next year.
Do you think people will push away from darker stuff, though? Do you think people will want to watch, like, nice, fluffy stuff more?
I bet we see, yeah. I think, I mean, I'm kind of that mind, I think, generally, is I don't understand, we were talking about this earlier, but I don't understand the sudden popularity of a film like Contagion, for instance. In times like this, I would prefer to watch something that does not remind me of the deadly and civil society threatening nature of pandemics.
Contagion is a particularly bizarre example, though, because, like, you haven't seen Contagion, have you?
I've not, no.
It's that film basically doesn't have a central character, doesn't really have a plot. That film's thrust and motif is, like, what if we went through exactly what would happen in a pandemic? Like, the only exciting thing about the film is, like, here's how we would disperse the vaccines. Here's how people would, like... Here's how businesses would be impacted. Here's how the stock market would be impacted. So it's, like, a weirdly... I mean, there's an argument, I think, for, like, in times like this, people want to see something that reflects what they feel inside. Contagion is a particularly upsetting example of that, though, because, like, it's designed to be an extremely accurate reflection of, like, what's going on. Like a
Shane Carruth version of...
Yeah, exactly.
Just laying out the facts.
Yeah, so I would understand more if, like, everyone was watching 28 Days Later, which no one seems to be doing.
Yeah, because that's catharsis, right? It's like you work through an extreme fantasy version in order to confront reality.
Yeah, and Danny Boyle, director of 28 Days Later, famously...
And Yesterday.
And Yesterday.
Film, which I watched on a plane.
famously very humane, very heartwarming, very optimistic director. Steven Soderbergh, director of Contagion, famously none of those things.
You hate Soderbergh, right?
I just think I get tricked into thinking that I like Soderbergh because he gives, like, very sweet interviews where he, like, talks about his love for cinema, but I just find his films cold and off-putting, to be honest.
Yeah.
They're intellectual exercises. They remind me... My life is being ruined at the moment because I'm doing a course on the philosophy of Richard Rorty, the American philosopher, And Soderbergh and Rorty are very similar, I feel. They do these, like, elaborately constructed puzzle boxes of art, which, like, are deliberately kind of designed to make you feel like an idiot. And it's just not what I go for. So we are gathered on this day.
Yeah, to talk about Brad Pitt.
To talk about the fashion of Brad Pitt. It was, I think, something that is brewing and we were talking about anyway, because I'm very interested in fashion. I actually think you're very interested in fashion too, Dan.
I think that might be true. I will accept that proposition.
I think about fashion more than ever these days. I'm like always thinking about it. It's unfortunate I'm currently quite unfashionable. These are my uni clothes. You're wearing
a Keith Haring shirt.
I'm wearing my Keith Haring American flag shirt. And I was in Officeworks the other day. An American guy came up to me and he was like, so the shirt is an American flag with like the little Keith Haring figures jumping in front of the flag. And this older gentleman came up to me and was like, I just have to ask, is that shirt saying that over in America they're all monkeys? And I was like, no, it's this. There's this artist called Keith Haring from the 80s. And he looked at me like he didn't know what the fuck I was saying.
Yeah, you're not speaking his language.
It reminded me of a conversation that we had about how much easier it would have just been if I'd said, yes, these are, that's no, exactly boy, what the yeah, shirt says.
Yes. We might have had that conversation. Did we have that conversation on the podcast?
We sure did. We opened our Cool World episode talking about how difficult it is to interact with other human beings.
That's right. I remember our friend Ned listened to that episode and used that data to have a revelation about how different we were. Not you and me, but me and him, or you and us and him.
Yeah, I think that's true.
That is something he never thinks about.
Dan, you are looking very stylish, speaking of fashion today.
You can only see I'm wearing a very typical Dan blue collared shirt, which I think there was a time. Why not tell this story on the podcast? Let me go back in time.
Please.
I was a young man, when I was in my teens, I had owned I think 6 Pearl Jam shirts.
Amazing.
And they're probably all still in my parents' house in Brisbane. I owned the classic Pearl Jam little alive man with his hands sticking out. I owned multiple tour shirts. I think in one tour I bought 2 shirts, in another tour I bought one shirt. They had a DVD they released of, I think, the European tour called something like Imagine in Corniche, which was like, well, I had a shirt of that that you bought online when you bought online when you bought the DVD online. And I just cycled through Pearl Jam shirts. That was basically my life. And I remember I had a crush on a girl. This is in like my late teens, and I was talking to a friend, and I said to her, I was talking about how I might be able to draw this girl's attention, and my friend said, maybe you'd wear less band shirts. And from that day forward,
that was it.
That was a real turning point.
Wow.
I still have band shirts, and I still wear band shirts. I have a nice Magnetic Field shirt. I have a nice LCD Sound System shirt. A couple of Mountain Goat shirts. I'm always happy to rep the Mountain Goats, but. When, like, I was probably, like, 18, I was just like, okay. And I just, around that time, I think I realized, like, what I need are clothes that fit.
Mm.
And if I am always a little bit formal, no one will ever be surprised when I dress up.
Mm.
Like, there's no, like, oh, like, what it's about not having a point where you walk into a room and someone is, like, surprised by you in any way. So if you're always, like, in between formal and casual, you can kind of go to either, and it's not noted. So I wear a lot of, like, kind of chinos, slim-cut jeans that are, like, move between business and casual, and a lot of collared shirts.
Hmm.
And that's kind of, and then a variety of jackets, and that's just kind of my... I think you would like... And sometimes I feel... I definitely respect your views on this, and I feel persuaded by it. But I think you would like me to do more subversive things, which I think is... good advice, but I'm kind of yet to, and every now and then I will.
I think,
but it's relatively rare.
I think you're very well placed.
That was me.
I think you're very well placed to be someone who would require very little fashion tweaking to throw your entire image into chaos in an exciting way.
Productive chaos.
Yeah. Wittgenstein's Tractatus, like
I love it.
His big famous philosophical work, the Philosopher Wittgenstein. The idea of that book, some people argue, is that you read the book all the way through and you think that he's presenting you everything that he agrees with, and then something sticks in your mind and the project of the book crumbles, and you reread it again, and you realize that he's not really endorsing anything that he presents. I think it's possible to do that with fashion. So if you wore this, like, kind of smart casual stuff, and then you had, like, a big chain in your nose or something, it would crumble the project in retrospect in an interesting way.
Working in academia, you kind of are permitted to do that. Mm. Like, you can have visible tattoos, you can have surprising jewelry. Like, you can't go entirely wild, but no one's stopping you. That's the thing. Like, there aren't gatekeepers of that kind of aesthetic.
I think that's...
But also, I think you have an extraordinary aesthetic that is simultaneously consistent and wide-ranging, which is hard to...
It kind of really only... My interest in fashion coincided with, like, a change in my life generally, where I gave up alcohol and just, like, a lot of things about me changed. I, like, widely came out and started telling people that I wasn't straight and all these things. And the fashion was a big... I think I'd always kind of been interested in other people who were well-dressed, but I wore exclusively band shirts and very baggy pants. And I remember one day my partner Brianna was, like, backing up her phone and all of her photos were flashing across her screen, and we were sitting there watching, like, our whole relationship get backed up onto a computer. And I saw all these photos of me in, like, you know, my punk shirts and these real baggy jeans, and I guess I saw that person from a third-person perspective at a time when I was vulnerable to reimagining myself anyway, because I was giving up alcohol, which had been such a big part of my life. And I just suddenly, I guess I realized, like, that's not who I am. I'm not that person. And when people when I walk into a room and people see a guy in a punk shirt and some, like, oversized sweatpant jeans, they don't know who I am. And wouldn't it be nice to dress how I feel?
Well, I think that's a really good point, right? And in speaking about fashion, there are arguments against fashion in that it, or certain kinds of commitment to fashion, in that it is, well, it's consumer-based often. It doesn't have to be, but it often is. And it seems superficial, right? It's like, no, you shouldn't judge a person for how they look, you should judge a person for who they are, which is broadly a reasonable, you know, prospect. But I think the wonderful thing about how one is able to dress and control their dress is that it's another opportunity to express yourself, and it's a very specific way of expressing yourself, which is can be liberating if approached in the right way.
I think so. I you know, I'm always moved by, although I don't like his entire philosophical project, I think Sartre on shame and is very interesting because he talks so much about how shame doesn't actually require other people. And it's just this byproduct of being what he calls a thing in the world. That he gives this example that you can, like, bend over and look through a keyhole and no one needs to be around you, but you can imagine yourself from a third person perspective in a way that causes you pain. So, like, there's something about being embodied which is kind of scary and makes you vulnerable. I think I used to feel that, and I think I feel much less of that now that I've come to terms with the fact I am a thing in the world. I am this embodied thing. Wouldn't it be nice to kind of, like, be interesting in the way that you're a thing in the world?
Yeah.
Including being kind of slightly either aligning with who I am or being deliberately indecipherable, which is the thing that I like to do too.
Yeah, clearly for committed listeners of this podcast, something that Joe loves, always compelled by, is indecipherability.
Yeah. I think I had the thing that you were saying before about these criticisms of fashion until I realized that, like, a good outfit works the way that a good movie works. In almost every claim you could make about a good outfit, you can make of a good movie. You're interacting with a person and aesthetic choices that reveal themselves through a person. I think a great outfit can even have a narrative. Dan's gotten very dark. There he is, he turned on the light.
Yeah, that was... So simultaneous. I intended to turn on the light. Joseph commented on my darkness, and then it was turned on. It was a real moment of synchronicity.
Good visual joke for a podcast.
For those listening at home, the sun is setting, and I am in my apartment. So what then might we interpret of Brad Pitt's character from his outfits? I guess would then be the question.
A fantastic question, because Pitt.
And I want to encourage. Yeah.
Go on. What are you going
to
say?
I was saying I want to encourage. What we will do with this episode is we will be talking about specific images, specific instances of Pitt. I think we'll put up a Twitter thread. Yeah. Would probably be the most effective way to do it, and people can follow along on that Twitter thread. If you're listening far in the future, just look to the date of this podcast release and check out the thread from that time.
Because Brad Pitt is, you know, part of being a man in Hollywood versus being a woman is that you tend to be less judged and talked about as an aesthetic object anyway. I think that's actually changing in the last couple of years. You see someone like Timothée Chalamet. Is that, how do you actually pronounce his name?
It's a good question, because according to the accent on the first A, it would be Timothée Chalamet. So I guess that's right. It sounds insane.
I've had his song Statistics. Do you know that song that he recorded as a 16-year-old? He did like some maths project that was a rap, and the video is available on the internet. It's just him going statistics, yeah, statistics. I've had it stuck in my head for like 4 days.
Damn.
I'll send it to you.
Please.
He queer baits, right? Chalamet queer baits, and I think there's not enough discussion about how he does that. But that's genuinely what we now think a well-dressed Hollywood man should do. Whereas when Pitt emerges, that no one really talked about his fashion.
I guess I couldn't say one way or the other. I assume that was the case.
If you look, when I was looking for like Brad Pitt fashion, you just, the only thing that people say, which I guess is our first image, which is worth talking about, which I'm going to click to now, is this meme that like a number of people have sent me and sent you and sent the podcast, and thank you for all of these people, because it's a very interesting point. Brad Pitt, the man who likes to look like his girlfriend, which is this like meme that's followed him for a while, which is a series of photographs of Pitt and the women that he's dated over the years, Angelina Jolie, Gwyneth Paltrow, Jennifer Aniston, and in each of them he's stylized kind of like them. Now, spoiler alert, I think Dan thinks that this meme is not accurate. You think he doesn't really dress like his girlfriends?
I guess I'm always skeptical of super curated memes like this, right? Because there's a number of factors at play. One is a lot of photos of Brad Pitt, a lot of photos of Brad Pitt with his girlfriends. If you've got a million photos to sift through, you're probably going to find some in which they resemble one another. Another factor is it's not an unheard of thing, especially in kind of formal occasions, for events which the sort of which Brad Pitt would often be attending, and at which he would often be photographed, you might try and synchronize your outfits to some degree.
Mm.
So I wonder if you could say the same about, you know, other A-listers. And yet, this remains a striking image.
I think it comes...
The hair especially.
The hair is a big part of it, I think. But I do think people... So much of the Pitt story is about his relationships. I think that's more what the meme gets to than
which he's been joking about lately as well, right?
He's been joking about a lot.
He made a lot of fun about that. He knows that.
Yeah. I mean, he said on the Marc Maron podcast, he's like, I can't stand next to someone without the press assuming that we're dating.
Yeah.
Which
happened with Alia Shawkat.
Yeah. And it's happened even more recently than that. There was a photograph of him at a Thundercat show, the musician Thundercat in LA, which, like, won't be happening, presumably, those anymore, because everyone will fucking be locked inside because coronavirus. And he was there with a woman, and all the press was speculating, like, who is this mystery woman that Pitt is being taken photographs with? But I think he actually... the aesthetic reinvention of Brad Pitt is a post-divorce thing. I think when you're looking at these early photos, he's not actually putting a lot of effort into how he looks, almost ever. Like, this meme of, like, him dressing like his partner, these are, I'm afraid to say, because we know that Brad Pitt's one of my favourite human beings in the world, these are unambitious looks, and I don't think he should receive much praise for
them. Universally.
I think he did the thing that, like, so many men of Hollywood did at this time, that, like, they didn't have to dress up, so they dressed to be comfortable. And so you get these photos of, like, him in a black shirt with a black blazer over the top.
I mean, have you seen that excellent Instagram account? I think it's called, like, Opening Night or something?
Yeah.
Which just has all the, like, it's an astonishing historical archive of red carpet shots from opening nights of films, from, like, 92 to 2007 or something, roughly? Mm. And it's shocking. Like, as someone who lived through all of that, I can't believe people were dressing so terribly and looked so slovenly, like, just universally. It's really wild. Like, people just were not, especially men. I mean, I guess even, I mean, everyone kind of is are, but men are not concerned with how they look. And I think if you remember, there's this moment in, what, maybe it's like 2005, where this word metrosexual comes into vogue. Mm-hmm. And it's funny looking back on that, because it was made a lot of, like, I mean, it's obviously homophobic, it's got homophobic, it's loaded in a homophobic way, but it's funny looking back on that, because I feel like in my memory at the time, one of the ways in which that was being, like, talked about on morning TV or whatever, you know, bullshit channels, has to do with it being, like, a new category, like something that hadn't existed before. Mm. So I guess there just wasn't, like, there wasn't space for men to like the way they looked.
I think that's true. That. I think it, you know...
Or to look like as if they had tried, right? To look as if they had put some effort into their aesthetic. That just wasn't an available category.
Unless, I think the two modes for being dressing as a man before, like, 2005, or three modes, either you're a queer person and then you have freedom to dress however you like, you're not put under this scrutiny... Or you're either wearing, like, a sweatshirt and pants, or you're dressed up in clothes that imply upper-class status. I think if you, like, three-breasted suits and, like... If you look, like, prior to 2005, the accepted modes are, like, Tom Wolfe in, like, white suit with white fedora. Yeah. Or, you know, like, Homer Simpson in, like, white shirt and jeans.
Well, there's also the interesting, I think... data point of the Matrix, right? Mm. Where people get suddenly very excited about long jackets and wraparound sunglasses. Okay. Like, that's suddenly like, oh, that somehow people understand to be cool. Which maybe it's kind of looped back around and is because it's so insane, but also, I mean, obviously the people who understand that are cool are largely spending like 16 hours a day in internet cafes also. But there is that, you know, that's... People are just very confused. But, throughout the 90s and 2000s.
But I think I
should probably qualify all of this by saying straight people.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think it's true. But I think it's interesting, and it's something I broadly feel about fashion too, is like the way that movies are aspirational, so many of like the key performances in the cinematic canon, so many of them are tied to outfits. And so many straight men go to these movies and get the thrill of like watching someone dress up. But for some reason...
James Bond.
I was thinking even something crazy like Travis Bickle. Like, Travis's green jacket is, like, such a signifier that makes so many people, like, lock into that character.
It's a little late, but the Gosling in Drive as well, the Scorpion jacket, yes, right?
Yes, absolutely. Or Cowboys, or, like, any of these modes.
Yeah.
You know, Pulp Fiction. Like, people go to the movies and love these costumes, but for some reason, for so long... toxic masculinity stopped people from being able to, like, spill that over into their lives. Because I mentioned it, I have to tell a brief anecdote about... Have you ever heard... for some reason, this has come up, like, fucking four times in this podcast, but Gaspar Noé loves the film Taxi Driver.
Okay.
If you find the quote where he talks about his love for Taxi Driver, one of the things that he says is he goes at length... about Travis Bickle's green Vietnam veteran jacket in that.
Okay.
And he's like, I bought a copy of that jacket and it allowed me to go into clubs that I wouldn't want to go to otherwise because I had the power of Travis Bickle, which is an insane Noé thing to say. Because like,
real unhinged. You could spend a lot of time unpacking that.
Because Bickle is not aspirational. But I think it speaks to the fact that like, movies can associate fashion with, like, this totemic power that is so much fun to play around with in your day-to-day life. And...
Well, we should get Brad Pitt's shirt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, for instance.
Mm, mm.
Wait, what was it? Wasn't it... There was a particular shirt, right, that you were very excited about?
He wears a yellow Hawaiian shirt, and I saw the film, and even when I was just out of Once Upon a Time and I couldn't entirely decide what I felt about that film... I bought a yellow Hawaiian shirt. He also wears like a Champion t-shirt, which I've started to see everywhere. It's fun. It's like really fun. And I think it's a shame that people just weren't allowing themselves to do it. But to talk about our next Pitt image, which is like Pitt as I think most people see him now, we have a photograph of Pitt in a white shirt with the classic like postman cap on.
And, I love this.
And black sweatpants, riding a bike down a hill.
I mean, not only is he riding a bike, but he is, like, side saddle on the bike. So yeah. He's kind of mounting, he's just standing on a pedal and has one leg artfully slid behind the other.
Does he have a headphone in as well, a single headphone?
He does have headphones, and notably they're not Bluetooth headphones, which Brad Pitt could definitely afford. They're corded, which would be pretty awkward on a bike.
And his big sunglasses, which I think have become his other trademark. Yeah.
Are they aviators?
Yeah, like those big black aviators that he starts to wear around. You know what? I actually think he cribs those aviators from Tyler Durden, the hero of Fight Club. Tyler wears like big gold aviators, and Brad starts doing that after he plays Tyler.
Interesting.
But this is what I like about this is I do think, and it's something worth talking about in all these discussions, is that is a distinctive Brad outfit. It's a fun Brad outfit. And it's not queer baiting. And I think, like, we as a society don't talk enough about particularly modern pop stars who deliberately bait queer audiences with what they dress in order, even though they are sometimes aggressively straight. And I think Brad actually, more and more these days, has, like, a lot of support in the queer community. And I think it's because he makes aesthetic choices like this, which is like suburban dad with the slightest twist. And I couldn't even point to the twist. No, he's not pandering.
I think so. Here's the thing about this outfit, I think. For one thing, it all fits perfectly. So the sweatpants, despite being sweatpants, right, so naturally relaxed, just fall, like, exactly where they're supposed to, above the heel. If I want to say those are Vans, like, a kind of a light blue Van, the sneakers. And so it all fits so well. It's also a very specific colour palette, right? You've got kind of a grey-blue cap to the blue-grey shoes, and then the grey sweatpants, the white shirt. It looks like he's just thrown it together, but it's coherent and it's elegant, despite being relaxed, which is a really hard thing to pull off, and obviously it helps that he's extremely handsome.
It does also trade in on what makes Brad Pitt such an interesting performer, that it is a sly embodiment of a masculine trope. It's like it's dad wear,
wonderful,
but like there's, you don't even know where the winking is coming from, but there is an element of a wink. I don't know how he does it.
He's also got the longish hair in this, so maybe it's, like, not quite shoulder length, but heading towards it. I mean, I don't want to be a skeptic. I don't want to bring down our boy. But you got to ask the question, would Brad Pitt have a stylist helping him out with outfits like this? Or is he just, this is his closet, he's throwing on some stuff. He wants to look presentable, but doesn't want to look done up.
I think that's a fair thing to ask about, like, Brad Pitt pre-interview with the vampire. But I think one thing that we have learnt doing this podcast is, like, that era, interview with the vampire era, is where he's just had a gutful with the entire industry. And obviously there's an element of, like, the self-styled outsider, but I think he genuinely is just, like, just wants to, from that point onward, just wants to smoke pot and go to cool shows and look at visual art. Like, I don't imagine that he's meeting with a stylist.
Well, I love that, because this is definitely the look of an artist who no longer needs to impress anyone, but cares about aesthetics.
Yes.
Like, that's, well, so you can, like, he's the artist, it's his show, he's turning up to the opening, and he cares about how he looks, but it doesn't matter what anyone thinks of him, and he kind of hates the people who he should be impressing.
Yeah.
I think there's something like that going on here.
I think that's true.
I think the cap is an interesting addition, because a lot of people just straight up can't get away with that, right?
Mm.
But Pete can, I think.
I think he looks good in the cap. He has, like, really leaned into the cap, particularly in the last, like, 6 years. He's very cap heavy. I don't know where it comes from, but it does kind of work.
It completes him in some ways.
I get jealous, though, because, like, I've got a big head. No caps fit my head. It hurts, and I get, like, the pink bands on my head. Like, my dad...
The pink bands are tough.
My dad tells this story that when he was a young man, he walked into a hat store, and the guy behind the counter took one look at my dad and was like, "We have no hats that fit you in here, sir." And my dad was like extremely pissed off, and he was like, as if, and he tries on every hat and no hat fits him. And I have the same, I'm cursed, genetically cursed with the same head. So
I have like a long, long head, kind of. And as a man with kind of minimal hair, I need, the sun safety can become an issue, obviously. So to be sensible, I have to incorporate, and I have to incorporate hats into my like wardrobe. And it's tough to pull them off, there's a wide range of outfits with which they just do not work. Mm. So I really respect Brad
for doing it. You could pull off like a Tyler the Creator style large fluoro beanie, like a big thick beanie.
I mean, I think so unfortunately, I don't look at the climate for it, generally. True. I do have some beanies.
I think.
And when you said Tyler the Creator, I thought you were going to be like a fluoro snapback.
Oh, I mean, well, that too. Tyler's like golf looks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The golf wang kind of vibe.
I mean, Tyler the Creator is probably, I think, one of our leading fashionistas in this age.
Definitely.
He's unbelievable.
Especially because he very explicitly does not follow any trend. He knows what works for him, and he just explores it.
And he also very explicitly creates looks that suit certain emotional periods in his life. Like this new look with the like double-breasted suit and the big blonde wig is like a breakup outfit. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. I wish more people did the thing of like, when you're a celebrity, we all know you're going through some kind of emotional journey. So embody that in like an outfit that speaks to it in an interesting way. But nobody does it.
Which Brad does. Brad does it within a narrow range, I think. Brad's not Tyler. I bet Brad and Tyler could be friends.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
If they're not already.
Well,
they would have a... if there was one of those, like, Interview Magazine puts two people together, I reckon Brad and Tyler would have an excellent conversation.
Well, Tyler likes Thundercat, and Brad was just at a Thundercat show, so we're...
Incredible.
If we were coronavirus, we would have made, like, two very quick jumps already. What? We have two more photographs of Brad. This one is not... Is a fairly amazing outfit, but... So it's
more about the look.
It's more
of expression.
Brad is sitting on a bench wearing a zip-up cardigan. Quite a Dan cardigan, actually.
I own a cardigan quite a lot like that.
Do you? It's got that collar, like the almost like communist China collar, which is like a very stiff upper collar. Yeah. He's wearing jeans and he has a glass of red wine in his hand. And you know the most amazing thing about this photo? He's sitting in a way that his jacket makes it look like... The cardigan is puffed up in a way that makes it look like he has a tummy that he doesn't have. If a photograph was taken of me in that position, it would make me look... it would be very unflattering.
It would be unflattering.
But for some reason, it's kind of deeply flattering to Pitt for some reason.
His head is... So this is, to clarify, this is almost certainly a... This is definitely a paparazzi photo, maybe even a telephoto lens paparazzi photo enlarged. So, I mean, what is you can imagine zooming out from this photo, and in fact it's a garden party, a wedding, something like that. But what it looks like in this framing is that Brad has wandered into a park alone with a glass of wine and is just contemplating something that has gone wrong.
I think we're looking at like quite close to divorce era Pitt here.
Pre or post, you know?
Post. It's definitely post, because it was circulating post-divorce. I mean, it's also worth saying we can date this pretty closely, because he, like me, is sober. So this must be very close to divorce. All he drinks is cranberry juice now. He made the crack that he must have the cleanest bladder in Hollywood.
he's got, like a third of a glass of red left in this photo.
Unless that's cranberry juice.
Oh, that's true. Not impossible. Yeah, we don't want to prejudge. He's got some stubble. He's a little puffy. Again, maybe it's just the Zoom doing him a disservice. But at the same time, he keeps... I mean, it's so different to the previous image, but he maintains his charisma. He's still got that, like, charge. And I think the interesting thing about Brad Pitt, like, looking between these two photos, what is so compelling about them is the way in which he is self-contained, right? Like, obviously these are photos of just Brad and no one else, but even when he's with other people, there's a sense of kind of self-assuredness, there's an internal life that other people aren't getting access to, that he's in control of. Even if he's going through a tough time, there's always a sense that ultimately he can look after himself. And that is something I think that is very alluring.
He has, I think, like, this natural... And it sounds like this is going to be the most reductive and obvious statement in the world. But he has a natural embodied charm that, like, just 99.9% of the population just don't have.
Yeah.
In the way that, like... Did you see the photos of Pitt? He went to some Academy Awards luncheon where everyone wears a name tag. And everyone laughed because he was wearing a Brad Pitt name tag. As in, like, who wouldn't know that he was Brad Pitt? But the extra level of the joke, I think, was that, like, there are some celebrities who, when you meet them, and I mean, like, I've interviewed some people who I know their face well before I meet them, they don't look the same. There's something, like, different, or there's something that the camera cannot capture.
Sure, yes.
Brad Pitt just is Brad Pitt, even in relaxed. It's not like, you know those photos of, like, George W. Bush doing jury duty? And he looks not really like George W. Bush. He looks like a slightly crumpled... Oh, yeah, an old man. Pitt never looks like anything but Brad Pitt.
Yeah. My sense is that he's... Yeah, there's a minimal difference between Pitt in real life and Pitt on screen as well. Like, you have... Yeah, I mean, you don't have a sense of curation in the same way you do with a lot of major actors. Actually, DiCaprio is often someone who looks quite different off screen as well.
It's true.
Like, he looks a little more sunken, a little more just less present.
Yes.
Than he does on the screen. Like, the camera loves him. I actually mentioned this just off air, but you haven't seen the Netflix series Cheer, have you?
No.
So I have been in my, like, it's been a tough month for everybody, but I have been slowly watching, which most people binged like 2 months ago, Cheer, which is about a cheer squad in, I think, Texas. And there's one of the big, it's a documentary, and one of the big breakout characters from that documentary, that a real life person, his name is Jerry, I think. He went on the Ellen show and then interviews a bunch of people on the red carpet, because Ellen kind of sends him to do this. And hasn't been a celebrity up until the release of the documentary, so he's obviously kind of very overwhelmed, and his kind of entire aesthetic is one of enthusiasm and good cheer. And one of the people he interviews is Brad Pitt. And that is interesting. The interviews, I think, who is it? Laura Dern, he clearly doesn't know who she is. I want to say maybe Reese Witherspoon. Remember, like, someone like Reese Witherspoon, and I think Laura Dern as well, they're both like, oh my God, I've seen your show, I love you, you know. And they have these really energetic moments. Whereas Brad Pitt is obviously like a little bit baffled.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not baffled in a way that feels like he's not able to perform himself. Like, this is kind of hard to express, right? But he's caught off guard. He's in a strange situation. He doesn't quite know how to handle it. And yet, it's not to do with him not being able to, like, put up the shield he puts up when he's performing or whatever. He's just Brad Pitt being baffled.
Yeah.
And I think that's really... Anyway, I don't know how clear that was as a...
No, I think it's true.
But even in his discomfort, he is himself.
Yeah. There is a video that I tweeted out through the Brad Pitt cast account of, like, obviously Brad Pitt won an Oscar. The other person who I love who won an Oscar on the same night is Hildur Gonaditur, who won for writing the score for Joker. She's a young composer who, like, that was a moment of great joy to me because I've followed her since she was, like, a weirdo ambient artist. And it was like... And there's this clip where she and her husband... That's the other thing, too. She was fun to watch through the Oscars because she's, like... You know, she's this outsider ambient person who's only made, like, 3 film scores and is, like, was kind of obviously really moved by the spectacle and it wasn't boring to her. And there's this video where, like, her and her composer husband are, like, meekly... She's getting her Oscar engraved. And Brad Pitt is talking to someone who's handing out canapes, like, oh, can I get one of those? And being naturally, effortlessly Brad Pitt. And there's a moment where he and Hilda lock eyes. And he's obviously aware that she's just won an Oscar, but doesn't seem to know her further than that. And they have this tiny exchange which speaks to what I think you're talking about with the bafflement, that, like, he at once seems like just a guy being friendly and also like Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
The Brad Pittness isn't eroded by the fact he seems very natural, which I think we're conditioned to expect.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really interesting, right? Because I definitely have a strong impulse not to idolize, not to deify. Maybe that's not true. I love idolizing and deifying people. But at the same time, it's kind of always undercut by an awareness that, like, hey, you don't want to put this person on a pedestal. You don't want to presume they're more than human. They're subject to the same force as everyone else. And also, you don't know them. Perhaps they have something very serious that that you would make you dislike them as a person, right? There's something about Pitt. There's something grounding about him. That kind of, like, it never seems in question that he's an ordinary person.
Mm.
You know, like, and that dynamic of this is an ordinary guy who is happens to be blessed with extraordinary charisma and talent and care. That seems so essential to making up for the, making up this particular response.
Yeah, I think there's something to the fact that he, you know, the people that you love in your life might be people who are very good at a particular skill, and that skill might be tied to what makes them good as a person. But you don't just love them for the skill. You love them because you see the skill as part of their... I mean, when I think about people who I, like, idolize, my creative writing teacher when I was a teenager is this incredible Australian author named John Hughes. I was very lucky to work under him. And, like, he was my creative writing teacher for 6 years, and he never once mentioned that he was a writer himself, even though he was quite an acclaimed and awarded writer. So I had this experience of, like, just as I was leaving, one of his newest books had been published, and he was like, oh, you should take this and read this. And I loved the work because I saw John in the... I'm just watching Ida. She's being naughty. No, she's being difficult all day. She knows we have treats. We have beef liver. So all day she's been harassing me. She knows that it's like when you're a kid and you know your parents have company over so you can ask questions and you couldn't ask otherwise. She knows that she can push me for beef liver when I'm meant to be doing something else. And I read John's book and I saw John in it, but it wasn't totalizing of John. And sometimes I feel the same way about Brad Pitt, that, like, I love him like a friend, and that love is what makes the artwork, not the other way around, like, weirdly. He's first and foremost, I'm interacting with the human being known as Brad Pitt. I'm just so happening to do that through art, weirdly.
Yes, and that is one of the most kind of wondrous experiences available in art, right, is the sense of being presented with another presence. Which is why, I mean, this is why, like, the fashion question is interesting. And I think the fashion piece kind of back in, thinking about the fashion piece back into the art in interesting ways, because when we see someone in an outfit, and yeah, I still have the skepticism about maybe there's a stylist, right? There's always this sense of, like, maybe it's not his choice. But when you see someone in an outfit, you can more or less think, well, you put this together. These are some choices you made. And I think we struggle, I think at least maybe I struggle, to think about acting performances in the same way. Like, it's... Because you don't... I mean, partially because, like, film's a big collaborative project, so you don't know where the director begins and the actor ends or whatever. But it's harder to sort of see, like, oh, this is a choice you made, this is a choice you made. And I think that's one of the great things about this podcast, actually, is seeing Brad Pitt repeatedly. It's like, oh, if you're doing this again, this is a choice you're making.
Mm.
You kind of get to flesh that out in a more, like, considered and deliberate way. This is why, yeah, I mean, this is, and again, you can say the same about his clothes. It's exciting. It's exciting to be able to think, oh, this guy made this choice.
Yeah, isn't it exciting? It's interesting to think of why it's exciting. Like, I'm back at uni, so I'm back talking and thinking about, like, all of the philosophers that I love and care about. And the other day I was at a lecture and they just happened to talk about Iris Murdoch, who's a philosopher who I love a huge amount. And they were talking about, it was like everyone there was a fan of Iris Murdoch. It was an elective lecture, basically. And there was a slide where they had a photograph just that Murdoch had taken of one of her cats. And everyone in the room made this, like, ooh sound of, like, you're seeing someone you love make a choice in the world, and it's so nice and so exciting. I mean, you had the experience, right, of, like, going to the Foster Wallace, where they have all of his books, and seeing, like, inscriptions he's made in books. And, like, why is that so exciting if not because you're, like, there's a choice that person made?
It's so much about that. And that was, yes, so the Wallace Archive in Texas it has hundreds of his books, and he annotated them very enthusiastically. And it feels, it's hard to describe. But again, it's the kind of grounding of the person in ordinary choices that simultaneously makes you feel closer to them, because there's a sense of them doing the kind of thing that you might choose to do. And there's also something even more, not that, like, again, with someone like Wallace, obviously, as much as I have a lot of time for him and his work, but you want to be careful not to just treat these things like sacred texts or whatever, right? Because that, not only is it misguided, but it often isn't very interesting if you kind of follow that path too rigorously. But they, I don't know, there's something magical about it. Like, it's this cross again between the kind of ordinary and the transcendent.
Yeah.
When you get access to these people.
I think so. And it's not, no one thinks that it's like real totalizing access. I don't think that, like, looking at Brad Pitt's fashion, I like suddenly know everything about him, like, really. But I,
yeah,
the things that I totally do know, I really know. I mean, the last boring philosophy example is, did you see, it actually did the rounds on Twitter recently, the Michel Foucault talking about the time he got hit by a car?
I'm sure I've seen that before, but I don't really remember it.
The continental philosopher Michel Foucault, who's the only good continental philosopher, by the way. All the others can go directly to hell. Foucault's great. And I tweeted this recently, but the reason Foucault's great is because he has a wonderful fashion sense, and he's the only well-dressed continental philosopher. The things that make him an interesting philosopher also make him a fashionable human being. Foucault got hit by a car, and he gave, in this interview, he described it, and he was like, it was not an unpleasant experience. Actually, what happened was, it was a beautiful autumn day, and I looked at the sun, and I had this feeling of great peace come over me, and I felt like everything was good and going to be okay. And all I need is one tidbit like that of Foucault explaining his relationship to things in the world, and his work is like lit up for me, entirety. And I mean, Pitt and his fashion and his movies, these things are the same. When I see someone standing in relation to things in the world in just the right way, like, I know we shouldn't deify people, but like, I'm all in for an extremely long time.
For sure. I mean, I've been reading a lot of... I'm giving a lecture on Montaigne soon, so I've been doing like a lot of rereading him and doing some research about him. And he had a near-death experience when he was relatively young. I think he was thrown off a horse.
Mm.
And he talks about that as being simultaneously a horrifying experience, but also kind of bringing him close to death in a way that he felt almost comforted by, feeling ecstasy in that moment as well. But so that made me think about Foucault being hit by the car. But the reason I bring up Montaigne is to think, like, that's why Montaigne is so incredible, is because he's giving you all of himself. Like, in his essays, and in, like, the essay form that follows, and so much of what's interesting in, like, contemporary, like, people like Nausgaard and all of the autofiction at the moment, which kind of obviously is indebted to Montaigne in some way. There's this tradition of self-reflexivity and self-consideration that I think is also why we have been so compelled by Brad Pitt's award run. Because not only has he given himself something of himself, but he's shown that he kind of knows how he's seen. He's shown that he, like, incorporates that. He's made a bunch of decisions. And then he felt genuinely moved when he won his Academy Award. There's all this kind of personal texture that gets enriched and just makes the entire experience of them, like, feeds back into the beauty of watching him in a film.
And it is, as you say, like, there is something wonderful about knowing that someone is, like, aware of the way that they are considered, the positive ways that they are considered. I mean, it might become an ongoing thread of the podcast, but Paul W.S. Anderson, director of the Resident Evil films, one of my favorite filmmakers, has a new film coming out in September. And I am allowed to say this. It's looking like there's an 70% chance, unless his film is pulled due to coronavirus, that I will get to talk to him. And
it's exciting,
sir. I'm so excited. I mean, it might not happen, but we'll see. And I'm literally, like, getting less sleep at night because I'm lying in bed imagining saying to Paul W.S. Anderson, who's a filmmaker who's been so badly treated by critics his whole life, I just want to know what he'd say when I say to him, are you aware that there are people out there like me? And there are a lot more of us, like Paul W.S. Anderson fans, who are, like, very into cinema and read Cahiers du Cinéma and, like, buy the Criterion Collection and treat his work seriously. And, like, wondering what he would say when you're like, do you know that we're out there, is so exciting to me. Because whatever answer he gives is good, like, whether he knows we exist or whether he doesn't, kind of like, I don't care. It's exciting.
Yeah, you can't, like, we are interested in texts because they're expressions of people.
Mm.
we are not interested in, you can't separate that from them. You can't, like, throw out the director or throw out the author. Obviously, like, the author isn't the place to go for answers for everything. But part of, like, in the way that we're interested in what people say because someone said it, we're interested in what Brad Pitt wears because Brad Pitt made a decision and what he, like, and the choices he makes in his films. Because it's Brad Pitt, obviously. And I feel like even, not just in kind of academic, discourse where people want to kind of push back on the idea of intentionality, which intentionality is a different question in some ways, but people are worried about it. But also just, I feel like even in popular culture, the way actors get consigned, especially someone like Brad Pitt, and when you look at the photo we were looking at earlier where, you know, the question is, Brad Pitt looks like his girlfriend. It's like, no wonder Brad Pitt is sick of the whole thing, because we're not interested in how he expresses himself in his cinema. We're interested in how he expresses himself in his private life, as if he's not giving us all this stuff on screen.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? Like, he's there. We don't need to go behind the scenes.
Absolutely. I think that's 100% true. I think it comes down to sometimes people want to know consistency. Like, they want to know, are you giving me the same thing that you embody in your private life? Mm-hmm. But who gives a shit? Extremely boring question, I think. Because there are ways in which, like, there are parts of me which are quote-unquote private, as in not everyone else sees them. And they're extremely boring. Like, I'm not withholding anything, but, like, when it's just me and the dog at home alone and I'm working all day, like, that's probably me at my most private. It's the part of me that nobody sees. And it's fucking so boring.
Also, we all believe that we hide certain parts of ourselves from the world, but we don't really. Like, we're all open books.
Yeah.
You know, more or less. You can just look at what's on the surface.
Yeah, and it's just as interesting. I think that's true. We should probably wrap up. We've been going for a despicably long time for a mini episode. We should do the last one. We should just a goodbye.
The sweater and the jeans and the, like, what are they, Clarks? I don't think they don't have any laces. I mean, this is a crazy look.
There is a recent, this is a recent photo set of Brad Pitt wearing what looks like slippers, tattered jeans, and a multi-tone green jumper.
It's like a gradient, so it goes from light to dark, from the top to the bottom.
I think it's his single best outfit that he's ever done.
I mean, he looks deranged. He's also, is that a necklace? It looks like a Tricochel necklace or something.
Well, we know from the interview with him and Sandler that he wears a lot of silver jewelry. He has, like, bands all up his arm in that interview.
The energy of this photo reminds me of the photo of Nick Cave and Johnny Greenwood meeting in, like, Greenwich Village.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's as if he's about to say hello to someone. He looks anticipatory. I mean, I see why you like this outfit, Joe. I love the sweater. I think this is probably something I could get over. I'm kind of against ripped jeans, just because, just wear, either rip them yourself, so, like, wear them down through use, or just wear straight-up jeans. I've never really understood it.
But I think I couldn't wear ripped-up jeans. I think you couldn't, but Brad Pitt can.
Yeah, true.
Brad Pitt is embodying an American ideal, and jeans and ripped jeans are such a part of the American fashion story. I mean, if either of us wore this outfit, we would not look interesting. We would not be fun.
I mean, we might look interesting, but not in this way.
It can't. There's something contextual, and that's what's great about fashion, right? Is that, like, you know, Harry Styles is, I think, an amazing fashionista we have at the moment. Okay. I think he makes unbelievable choices, but they're choices that wouldn't work on someone like Timothée Chalamet because yes. Styles is actually queer. I mean, that goes a long way to, like, you know, how I feel about someone who's clearly
is he out? Is Styles queer? Is that
he's as close to out as you can be, I think.
Like, okay.
Have you seen the latest run of music videos?
No.
Unless we're talking, like, very high profile performance art in a way that I think he would realize would be, like, a mistake to, like, very, like, to court that in such an explicit way would backfire quite badly, I think.
Okay.
I'm sure he's bi. I'm pretty sure he's bi. But, like, that, yeah, outfits are contextual in a really exciting way.
I mean, the hat looks like it's been through the washer, like, washing machine. It's just, it's a, like, tattered kind of...
It's kind of Freddy Krueger.
definitely great, amazing. And then he's wearing Wayfarers. But and there's shoes are kind of very soft, like a Clark's Desert boot, but without the laces. Mm. And the jeans are rolled up, so the sweater doesn't. I mean, I was doing some thrift shopping when I was in America, and I had a lot of sweaters. So I was like, the arms are too long, too baggy. But and again, it's going to be different on me and Brad Pitt, but. He's really, like, his arms are too long, but man, he's pulling it off.
Yeah. It is also interesting. I mean, we talked about him just before, right? But I'm sure you know. I mean, you know more about David Foster Wallace than I do. But you know all that stuff about Foster Wallace being quite uncomfortable about, say, his, like, bandana becoming a visual icon? He was like, honestly, I'm not performing anything. It's just because I get very sweaty.
He sweated. It was a problem all his life. He sweated a lot, yeah.
But it's interesting to me that, like, Pitt is not uncomfortable. And I'm always a little bit disappointed when I read those Foster Wallace interview quotes where he's like, I don't do the bandana for a bit. I'm like, I'd love you to do it as a bit. In the same way that I love the way that Pitt is playing with aesthetics here. Like, he's aware.
I think the art world has probably, and then you can't say this for many people, I think the art world has probably been quite good for Pitt.
Mm.
Because I think, like, there's so few industries from which the art world is a step down, but Hollywood is one. And I think he would be... He'd also be dealing with people from a lot of different classes, probably, or at least in a way that you're... I mean, the art world's pretty stratified and obviously has an enormous amount of wealth in it that is problematic, but you have to deal with, like, artists who are not doing that well. If you're, like, serious about it, you're going to be dealing with a lot of, like, you're in and out of openings and dealing with, like, young artists and obviously then gallery owners and dealers and stuff. There's, like, a lot of different types of people. And I bet he's been able to, if that's something that he's kind of really been involved with, he will have been able to, like, pick and choose a lot of different ways of being from that world that would not be available to him in Hollywood.
I think that's true.
And I think this is evidence of that.
I think it's also interesting the way that, as we said before, all of that aesthetic stuff happened post-divorce. It's interesting that this is a divorce from Angelina Jolie, and she goes the opposite way. Jolie, like, basically doesn't care, apparently seem to care about fashion at all anymore. Like, around the time of this divorce, she basically stopped making movies on screen and just became a director. And her outfit resembled that change, that now she's like, you know, just black work clothes that you would just use when you're a director making the kind of films that she makes, which are quite they're often set in, like, remote locations and they're physically demanding shoots. It's interesting. I can't wait till we get to talk about Angelina Jolie. She's been denied to us for such a long time. I love her. I love her so much.
Okay. I have no real strong feelings about her, actually. I don't think I've been exposed to her enough.
I think she, and I mean, obviously there's always some politics at play when you're a man talking about a woman, the way a woman looks first and foremost.
Sure.
But I think Angelina Jolie has one of the most extraordinary faces that cinema has ever seen. It's unbelievable. Yeah, that's right. It's genuinely unbelievable. Maybe we should do Jolie right after Pitt.
I mean, that would be... So I would be a fan of that, except it would seem too contingent, maybe. But we could.
We could circle around. We could do... We could do it one by one. We could do the step-by-step thing, right?
That's true.
We'll see. Cameron Diaz, then Angelina.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of a pun for Angelina Jolie in podcast, but there's nothing really available.
It's hard. It's harder for Cameron Diaz.
Talking
Diaz, discussing Diaz, like, we'd be pretty fucked. It was an interesting... Maybe this is, like, a nice final... Or an interesting final note. I think... This podcast will explain itself even more when we do someone else. Because sometimes I wonder, like, have we just got very lucky that the first person we did is someone who's, like, would we necessarily feel... And I love Cameron Diaz, but would we necessarily feel warmth to Cameron Diaz, who maybe is someone who makes decisions very differently?
Well, not only that, I think it's harder for a woman in Hollywood to present as your friend. I don't know if that... Because I think there are more conditions and restrictions on what a woman is available to do. I think Pitt can be, like, a friendly guy who plays a lot of different types of person, and you kind of see him form, as you see him from an increasingly various set of angles. And I think women just have fewer types of roles available to them and have to make harsher decisions about what they can do. And I wonder if that just makes it, like, it's not so much about personality, but about availability of, like, casting.
Sure. But, and yeah, I think that's true. Because, like, the Cameron Diaz story ends. She's retired from the screen. And so the whole podcast would be, like, working out if you can understand why she retired. And
well, you know what would be interesting?
Mm.
If we did it backwards.
Yeah.
Instead of forwards.
And if we...
if it's the, like, how did she retire? It's like the, like... I mean, I'm sure you could... Well, I don't want to use Irreversible as an example. But a film that, like, explains an event in reverse.
Yeah, I think that's true. It would, like, slowly maybe come into focus what happened to her. We could also just do... That makes me think of, like, a... Speaking about movies that you don't want to invoke, that's almost like a Human Centipede thing. If we did, like, Brad Pitt from beginning to end, and then Cameron Diaz from end to beginning, and then if we just did those two forever, like, passing back and forth through the Human Centipede of podcasts. This has been our special minisode of the Brad Pitt cast.
Thank you so much, everybody. And I hope... I appreciate you putting up with my voice in this way. It won't always be like this unless we get quarantined, in which case it may be.
Yeah. If one of us gets
possible.
If one of us gets the Roni, as people are now calling it, then
Just contact, right? Like, at the moment, if you're anyway, we don't need to go into that. And I'm sorry, we don't want to bring people down. There's a lot to love in the world still. We've got Brad Pitt with us.
Absolutely.
We've got Dan and Joe with you.
Brad Pitt will be, wherever he is, will be fine. You saying that you've got Dan and Joe makes me think of something I wanted to do at the end of the last episode and I forgot to do. We had special guest Haley. That was the last episode we recorded. Yeah. You won't hear it for a while. I wanted to quickly say thank you to, by name, a key number of fans who listen to this podcast
and
message me about it and talk to me about it. I'd like to say their names in a big long list, like the special thanks coming up at the end of the screen. Desi, I should have written this down, because if I forget someone...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I hope you wrote it down.
I'm so sorry. Desi, Doug, Juliet, Haley, oh God, there are more people. Dan, help me.
Harry?
Harry, Ned, how's Whittaker? Yeah. Eleanor, Manny Lazic, Elena Lazic. Who else listens to this show? I think I got Rhiannon, my dad.
My mum sometimes.
Dan's mum sometimes. She's not in the top tier of fans.
No, she is. Well, I mean, as, like, as a
substantively person, as a person, she's...
Yeah,
absolutely.
Look, if we've left you out, email bradpittcast@gmail.com and get mad at us and we'll include you next time.
At some
point that will be a Patreon perk, but for now you get it free.
Yeah, I fucking forgot the main person who I wanted to thank that prompted this whole fucking thing. Aiden, I love ya. You're a top tier fan. Thank you so much. You're all top tier fans. I love you all terribly.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous to us that, like, that you listen every week and it means something to you, because it means so much to us.
It means a lot to us, and it's a real surprise. It's not. Not surprising. Like, I'm proud of what we do. I genuinely am. But we didn't expect anyone to listen. And the fact that people are listening and committing is really, really delightful. And I should also say, there has been some erraticness with the podcast lately. And that is entirely on me. It is not at all on Joe. I have had a very erratic and stressful schedule. And sometimes I kind of things. I'm doing fine, but, you know.
It's been a tough month for everybody.
But we'll keep turning up in your ears. Just bear with us.
Sophie is another top fan. We'll do a compendium of people because you're all the best. And we'll either, the next time you hear from us, will either be, depending on timing, another mini-sode quarantine Dan on my phone about Brad Pitt's hair.
We're going to get to the hair.
Or it will be 12 Monkeys. I can't work out time-wise which one we'll record next.
But you will hear us at some point in the near future.
In the very near future. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please do stay safe. It is genuinely stressful and strange times. You know, it's fun to live through strange times. Sometimes a little bit scary. So we're here for you emotionally.
Yeah, we love you. We'll see you next time. Bye.
See you next time.